Well, thank you, Farbod and Federica, for the presentation. I've followed the dynamic engagement of many of you. We've captured a lot of questions, a couple of which Farbod addressed upon finishing the formal part of the presentation. I'd like to start with a couple of overarching questions. These came in a little earlier in the presentation, and I want to turn back to Farbod and Federica just to provide some additional background on the tool so that we can address these questions, and then we'll move on to some of the others that we received. So I'm going to ask three questions. We'll answer those and then move on. There was a question that came in early in the presentation related to how the project handled gender. That was something that Federica shared. It's part of the project, but I think there's an interest in understanding a little bit more about how it's been considered from the beginning. There was also a question related to how often is the tool updated? Is this tool for advocacy? That came from Carrie Hubble Melgarejo. There's another overarching question that I'm going to direct to Federica and Farbod is the possibility of accessing raw data. And once we cover that, we'll go on. So turning back to Federica and Farbod.
Yes, happy to start by referring to the question on gender. We, from the outset of the project, we were very clear that gender was to be an important component of our work. And not only gender, I think this is equally applicable to the environmental sustainability one. We held discussions on these from early on to see, again, what are the key issues, what are the key constraints, what are some of the regulations that have an impact on gender and environmental sustainability issues. However, if you haven't noticed already, we've wanted to be very careful and responsible in developing our indicators. And so that's why actually first in year one, we had this pilot experience where we measured a bunch of different aspects and areas in 10 countries. We wanted to draw some lessons from that. And based on those lessons, we wanted to begin focusing on a few topic areas. Developing our methodology, testing our methodology, and that's why we selected early on to focus on those six core topic areas that we mentioned. However, the other topic areas, and gender and environmental sustainability included, have been at the forefront of our minds all along. We've been waiting to see how this year two goes to understand better how to embed it. And now, in retrospect, I think it has been a wise decision, because now that we have collected, we had the pilot year experience, we started scoring the six topic areas, we have a better feeling of how we can embed data points into the different topic areas to be able to issue and to share some more significant results on this topic area. And again, this is the same thing for environmental sustainability. And what you see, for example, in gender is that we have data points embedded in, for example, land, the land topic area. We look at sex disaggregated data and registries, and how we know that when data is presented in a sex disaggregated way, this has an impact on targets, on aims, and in participation of gender, and this is not only in land registries, but also water right registries and financial institutions and cooperative registries. So that's one element that we look into. We also look at restrictions to women's employment and activity. So, for example, are there restrictions to women driving trucks? So that's within our topic, the transport topic area. Are there restrictions to women producing or handling or using fertilizers, either organic or chemical? So that's in our fertilizer topic area. We're operating agricultural machinery in our machinery topic area. We also look at another aspect we looked at is women's participation and also leadership in collective groups and cooperatives and associations. So you see, as a result, even though it was we wanted to tackle it early on. As a result of this work that we've been able to do to now, now we can embed it much more effectively in those other topic areas. So you should probably expect in the next report some interesting results on that topic area and on environmental sustainability.
Perhaps if I could just add to what Fabio just explained, how we developed our indicators. I also would like to mention that we've been working closely with another group within the World Bank that you might be familiar with. They've been producing a report called Women, Business and the Law. They've been producing this report for the past 8 years and leveraging a number of reforms. You know, the main result that comes from that report is that actually business regulations are gender neutral. So they had to look into family law and the different set of laws beyond the business regulation. So we partner up with them and make sure we don't duplicate our work, actually that we complement their work. And so that has clearly had an impact on the way we developed our indicators. Again, we try to leverage what data set, and we hope to come up with a more comprehensive, actually, analysis using the data that we produce and then they produce, and they will be published in for the first time in the report, and they will be released in January next year. Perhaps I can address the question about how often the data is collected. So the EBA is meant to be a three-year project, 3 years that have been used. We are almost close to the end, to the third year, to develop our methodological approach. As you can imagine, it's been very complex to develop those indicators across 12 topics for agribusiness, especially compared to the indicators that doing business has developed so far. It's been a very complex and challenging exercise. So we basically agreed with our donors to allow 3 years of as a first cycle of EBA in which we collected data every single year. So again, we'll have yearly reports, two already published and one will be coming in January. Now, moving to the next phase of EBA, we still don't know how often and, you know, if we will be collecting this data. We clearly recognize the importance of monitoring progress, and not only because this is a great leverage for policymakers. If they implement a reform, they want to acknowledge, they want their reform to be acknowledged and also the progress to be tracked. So it will be critical, as I mentioned in the beginning, to try to address those questions of what is the impact of laws and regulation on certain important outcomes like agriculture productivity or, again, agriculture transformation. And it is, you know, can we analyze the impact of those regulations without adding other elements into the picture? And what are those other elements? So, you know, we see the value of continuing collecting this data regularly, not only again to motivate policymakers, but also to better understand certain issues. With that said, though, we really think that collecting data every year is not necessary for EBA, but rather every other year. Those reforms don't take place every month, and it takes some time to see the impact of a reform in the agriculture and agribusiness sector. So that's a potential plan, but there is no decision has been made so far. In terms of accessing the raw data, so on our website, we publish and we make available all the data points used for scores. So if you look at our website and you click on the scores, you can see that all the questions that have been aggregated to obtain their scores are actually available. Now, we collected more data points, way more, and those data points are not published on our website, but we'll be happy to provide these data points. There is you can reach out to us or just put that request in our website, and then we'll be happy to share this additional data. Some of them are not fully comparable. Some of them have been collected only for 1 year because some of them, turn out to be not relevant, or we didn't observe any variance across countries, but we'll be happy to share the full set of data that we collected if you're interested in requesting it. And I think, Kelly, we address all the questions that you posed.
Thank you, Federica and Farbod. So I'm going to ask, I'll direct a few more to Federica and Farbod and ask that your responses be brief so that we can get through some of these. There were a few questions related to content of indicators, and I'm going to ask Farbod and Federica to kind of address these via chat. But I'd like to have more of a discussion about kind of some future-oriented discussion about how these scores what kind of effect these scores will have. We have a couple of questions related to that, one coming from Stephen Mink, another from Megan Murphy. Megan asks, focusing on changing the score could pose some interesting dilemmas in terms of prioritization of reforms. Changing your score with one reform may or may not result in certain other goals for reform. In your discussions with governments, what other questions are coming up when prioritizing reforms for EBA? And I believe related is a question that came in from Stephen Mink. As EBA adds countries, what is the increase in the number of people involved in doing the scoring? As this grows, how do you get consistency across scorers, so that there's stability across countries in time? So I'd like to ask Federica and Farbod to respond to that. So these questions are related to the evolution of the tool and how it's put into practice and used. So I'll let you decide who wants to go first.
Very good. We'll combine forces on such good questions. Maybe I'll address at least one of the aspects of this question. Clearly, what our methodology attempts to do is to highlight some priority areas. Amongst the many things we could measure and the many things we could score, it's been the consultations with evidence and consultations with experts, which has led us to targeting what are key regulatory good practices that are constraining value chain processes in a country. And so in our discussions with governments, actually, one of the things they're interested, obviously, in the full data set what we bring, and they're aware that this is a first stage of this data set. They're very much looking forward to next year's data set, in which we'll plan to score some of the more practical dimensions that we referred to in our presentation, in which we'll bring in a number of other topic areas that are going to be scored, and issues related to gender and sustainability. But even at this early point when they see the data, first of all, they're interested in prioritizing areas where they're below the average. So you remember that most countries have some areas where they're stronger in and some countries that they're weaker in. And clearly those red dots do generate a reaction, and it's the first areas that governments want to look at and want to try to improve. And that is, in fact, the whole objective of our methodology, of our system, is to be able to highlight the areas where there's greatest room for improvement and the greatest need for improvement. And then we actually, in the discussions that take place in those areas that are weakest, we dig deeper. So we go into the specific data points, we share with them our scoring, what areas they score low in, what aspects are missing, and which ones have the highest score or have the highest impact on the score, the lowest impact on the score. And those are the questions that come up that ultimately you can tell that in their thinking and their understanding our data, they're paying most attention to. So it's very interesting to see this kind of interface between our methodology and the objective of our methodology and the questions they raise and the areas that they're starting to pay attention to based on the data that we present to them.
I would like to try to address Steve's question, which is, I think it's a great question. And So let me try to explain a little bit how we're trying to, how we're proceeding and how we try to ensure stability. So as I mentioned, we gave ourselves 3 full years, almost 4 actually, to come up with a more stable methodology. So why, you know, it's taking 3 years to finalize this course and finalize the methodology? Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, every time we scale up data collection and we further tested our indicators, you know, there were some lessons learned. Since the very beginning, we tried to incorporate lessons learned from doing business colleagues, for example, but as we started EBA, we realized it was a completely different animal. So we actually, not only we paid a lot of attention to these lessons learned, but we also built on those. So in fact, you can see significant changes between the results from the pilot and the results for the scale up to the 40 countries. And you know, we'll see more changes in the next report that we'll be publishing. In fact, last year we finalized data collection in July 2015. And to come up with the new questionnaires or the refined questionnaire, because we try to maintain some consistency across already, you know, the pilot year and the second year and the third, it took almost 6 months for us. So it was a very in-depth review. We benefited from input from a lot of relevant stakeholders, from World Bank colleagues and you know, from civil society, etc. So basically, in a nutshell, I would like to emphasize the importance of, you know, allowing enough time to come up with a robust methodology. And robust means a lot of things for EBA. Not only robust from a technical standpoint, but again, we need to pay attention to how relevant is what we measure. And you know, there is no better way to test that than interacting with stakeholders and with policymakers, of course. But there are two more aspects that I would like to mention that are critical in keeping thinking about our timeline and how and if we get to a stable methodology. In order to develop scores, we clearly needed to refer to internationally accepted good practices. And for some of them, you know, there is a lot of evidence and research. For some of them, it took a lot of time for us because, you know, research is not there, evidence is not there. So we had to do a huge work of interaction with, you know, a lot of stakeholders, companies, policymakers, civil society, farmers association, etc. But for a lot of them, there are not good practices, and especially for the time and cost indicators. In fact, you know, if we ask ourselves the question, how long it should take to register a new seed variety? It's 5 days, it is, you know, 60 days, it is 600 days. So we don't know. In order for us to come up with thresholds and be able to score those very important variables, you know, we need a larger sample. So with a sample of 60 countries this year, we'll do further analysis that we already did during the past 2 years, and again, try to build new evidence and come up with new good practices. And be able to score those very important time and cost dimensions. Now, we cannot exclude the fact that moving forward, EBA might need more revisions of the scoring methodology. Just as an example, Doing Business went through 3 very important refinements of the methodology. The last one happened during the past 2 years. And in fact, they had to include quality of regulations related aspects. And it was a big change, and, you know, the scores changed. But again, to the extent possible, keep into consideration all those challenges that we face, we believe that after the third year of EBA, we'll be able to maintain stability and comparability across years. So we totally agree it is very important for, you know, policymaking purposes, and again, for research or you know, just for analytical purposes.
Thank you, Federico and Farbod. The last question to Federico and Farbod and comes from Rosemary Nyoka, and she asks about how the macro level information that is generated through the EBA tool is linked to grassroots smallholder farmers as a way of achieving an inclusive enabling environment in agriculture. This could lead to a lengthy response, but why don't you give us your short answer and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you for the opportunity to answer this question. I think it's a very key question. In fact, that comment of macro levels is a very good one. A lot of policymakers and some of our colleagues in the different countries have commented that one of the greatest strengths of this work is that it kickstarts many discussions. It puts some issues on the table, and to the degree that it links with other data that exists, with other analyses that exist, it really gives for a very powerful analysis. Now, how can it be linked to the grassroots farmers, smallhold farmers? So one thing to be aware of is this is one of the complexities of agriculture and agribusiness, that we have a range not only of countries and conditions, of stages of agricultural transformation, but also of the kinds of actors that we have in this. And we have the large firms and corporations, multinational, and we have small farmers and producers, and they all represent the private sector, and we want to make sure we're benefiting them all with some of the regulations that we're looking at. And this is the case. We have made sure that we do cover the range of private sector actors. In some topics, you'll find that, in fact, it's the smaller producers, the smaller actors, the smaller farmers who are more targeted. One example of that is our land indicators, which we haven't presented in this case. You can see some references to it in our report. But everything that has to do with inclusion, with tenure rights, with transparency, with procedural safeguards in case of expropriations. I mean, all the elements that we're looking at have a very are highly relevant to smallholder farmers. Same with markets. In markets, as we mentioned earlier in our presentation, one of the aspects that we look at is cooperative action and contracting and being able to connect into domestic markets. So, if you notice, the data points associated to that and the regulations that we measure are very relevant for smallholder farmers. Now, sure, there might be other areas that target larger firms, areas such as fertilizer and inputs, which require some bigger actors. But again, its aim is to ultimately foster the availability of these inputs for the smallholder farmers. And there's plenty of evidence that says that by addressing some of these regulations, accessibility is impacted. So that's just, I mean, trying to stay within the time limits. That's a quick overview of our work and its relevance to smallholder farmers.
Well, thank you, Farbod, and again, thanks to both Farbod and Federica for the presentation and the thorough responses. We've come to the end of the webinar, and I want to thank everybody for your active participation. It's been exciting to see so much interest. I hope that it's sustained interest. A couple of observations I made from following the chat. Seed systems is a big, it gets a lot of our attention. It'll be interesting to see how this tool might inform policy dialogue around changes in the enabling environment for seed systems in particular, among a number of other factors and topics that affect the work that we do in the agricultural sector in support of food security. I'm going to wrap up a couple of other key takeaways. We've learned, and Federica mentioned this at the beginning of her presentation, that the EBA tool is really it's a starting point. We already have seen how it's getting policymakers' attention. It can generate momentum for reform, which is great. But we need to make sure that we don't rush to that governments don't rush to address these scores, and that the voices of citizens, private sector stakeholders is not lost. I thought Tom Sanderson raised a really good point when he reminded us about the role of media, something that we can consider as we think about how these data generated within the EBA tool can inform policy dialogue. That's certainly our expectation, and I know we're eager to see how that's going to play out. So again, the EBA tool, it's a means of sparking policy dialogue. It, I believe, will be effective at revealing the symptoms of a poor enabling environment, but it doesn't diagnose the root causes of these symptoms. And I think that that Federica and Farbod will also agree that to really get at that, an understanding of those root causes requires deeper qualitative analysis of political economy, institutional development, social dynamics. So excited that this tool can be a part of that process. And in conclusion, I wanted to note that the Bureau for Food Security's Office of Market and Partnership Innovations is available to help. In addition to I know the EBA team who welcomes feedback and will be responsive to questions, the Feed the Future Enabling Environment for Food Security project has also done in-depth analysis of the methodology and is available as a resource to brief missions and field questions on aspects of the methodology. They can assist with understanding how to employ the EBA in the context of Feed the Future programming. They can also be a resource in facilitating stakeholder dialogue that could potentially be a complement to some of the outreach work that the EBA team has talked about here today. With that, we'll be sharing post-event resources within a week. So again, thank you so much to everybody for joining the webinar today and for your active participation.